Please silence all electronic devices.
Mr. Speaker!
I have said this since the end of June. I'm surprised that the entire budget was held up over one policy issue.
Lord, strike me down if I vote for this bill.
You are making a mockery of this process. You are deceiving all of North Carolina. Your leadership is an embarrassment to the history of this great state.
Any further discussion or debate?
Welcome to the WUNC Politics Podcast. Don't touch your dial or be alarmed by the new voice. I'm Will Michaels, filling in for Jeff DeBeery. He will be back next week. But in the meantime, I'll be your steward for this conversation about the week in North Carolina politics. And we do have a lot to get to, so let's get right into it. With you, as always, are Becky Gray of the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield of the progressive NC Policy Watch. It's a pleasure to host you both this week.
Thanks.
Nice to be with you.
So this week marked 100 days since Governor Roy Cooper issued a statewide stay-at-home order as the spread of COVID-19 was first accelerating. He's, of course, issued other executive orders restricting access to restaurants, bars, and other businesses. Those orders were again front and center at the legislature this week as lawmakers in the Republican majority attempted but failed to override the governor's vetoes of bills that would have reopened some of those businesses. This legislature is not expected to reconvene until September. Becky, is this the last word when it comes to the way that businesses will reopen during the pandemic?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've seen some of these go before judges, that some of these entities, whether it's gyms, whether it's bars, we saw a ruling this week on bowling alleys. So no, this is not the end of it. I mean, the General Assembly has one voice in this, but these businesses are so frustrated that, you know, they're just using every avenue that they can possibly come up with to get some relief, be able to open safely. And so I think that they will continue to explore those as long as the governor's executive orders keep them shut down.
I don't think it's the end of it either. I mean, I think even Governor Cooper is the first to say he continues to review it on a daily basis and will be making new announcements as we go forward. Hopefully, we'll make some progress in reducing the numbers. That'll give us a chance to open up. But I think, you know, this is really this what's gone on this week is really just more of the same thing. We've had this debate between how quickly we should open as a state and as states throughout the Southeast are now finding out rapid reopening is a real problem. And Governor Cooper is obviously very concerned that our hospitalizations, our infections continue to rise in the state. And so I expect him to continue to keep as tight a lid on it as possible. But obviously he's frustrated. We're all frustrated. We all would love for businesses to open. It's just a question, is it worth sacrificing lives to do it? So obviously it's not the end of it. We're going to be debating this, you know, until the pandemic is over.
And until these businesses are allowed to open, you know, is really where the end of this is going to be. But I think where the governor and all of us with this question about how quickly or how slowly do you reopen is, as you begin to open up that dimmer switch, there are some that are allowed to open and some aren't. And therein lies the problem and the question and really the reason for these lawsuits is a lot of, you know, well, if bars and restaurants can open, then why can't freestanding bars open? And the governor has said you have to have these certain cleaning protocols in place. So businesses now are saying, okay, we have the cleaning protocols in place. Why can't we open? So again, you know, Rob, I completely agree with you. This is going to continue to go on until we're past this and all businesses can be open and, you know, back in business.
I think the one thing that we need to say, though, about the vetoes is that there was no chance they were going to be overridden. It's the same story we've seen really since the Democrats won back, defeated the supermajorities at the General Assembly, that the legislature has just sort of continue to take the stance, well, we're going to see if we can override Governor Cooper, or we're going to make a political statement. We're not going to really sit down, go into a room, lock ourselves there, and try to come up with a compromise and cut a deal. It's the same problem we have with the budget. I wish very much that we could have done that. I think it would be a stronger solution for the state if the governor would have been able to get some sort of compromise out of the General Assembly. But they seem to have decided they're going to stay adversarial and roll the dice in the 2020 election and see what that does for them.
In some of these, I mean, there is no compromise. I mean, you can either open or you can't. I mean, that's what we've come down to. That's why so many of these businesses have turned to the courts to make where a judge will make a decision, either yes or no. Very little room for real compromise.
Well, since we are talking politics, though, why do you think that the legislature brought these veto overrides up to begin with if, Rob, as you say, there was really no chance that they were going to be overridden?
I don't know. It seems to me that it's making a political stance. I think we have to keep in mind that not all the bills that they sought to seek an override on had to do with COVID or the reopening. There was also a bill on carrying concealed weapons onto schools that happened to have religious services. That was another one where there was no evidence really that they were going to succeed. And I think it was mostly making a statement to their political contributors, to their people on their side that, you know, that they were fighting for their cause. But again, it's not a very effective way to run a government. And it really speaks to the sort of gridlock we've got in North Carolina right now that and, you know, there's, I guess, a lot of hope that the 2020 election will make a difference in solving that problem. But right now, it seems that we're at loggerheads. And I think the hope, perhaps, that we might have come to a point where we would find some compromise, find some common ground, it's just not materialized.
I have to disagree. I think that it's easy to say that all of these things are political and then just dismiss them. But just in the case of the Second Amendment Protection Act, which would have allowed concealed handgun permits to carry firearms on in churches where there are schools located, that bill originally passed the House 77-38, which would have met the three-fifths threshold if all of those votes had held with a veto override. So I think, you know, what we've seen consistently happen with this is, in many cases, the votes are there in the original legislation that goes through. The governor vetoes the bill, and then he puts tremendous pressure on the Democratic members of the General Assembly to stick with him. We've even heard some members of the General Assembly, some Democrat members of the General Assembly, say, you know, it's one thing when I'm voting on a bill, the merits of a bill. When it comes to the veto, then it really becomes a loyalty to party kind of vote. And I think that's what we've seen. I think that's what we've seen with these veto overrides.
Which is the same thing that we see from the Republican members of the General Assembly who don't want to cross the Speaker, who don't want to cross the Senate President pro tem because they know that they'll get payback in terms of their committee assignments. I mean, that's the way politics works. But I think it's clear that there was not going to be a veto override. The Democrats have proved that over and over again. I think it was a waste of time to have these votes this week when we could have been doing something useful.
Well, you know, tell that to the owners of these small businesses that have been cut completely closed down since March, you know, through no fault of their own. I think that, you know, there had to be a goodwill effort to try one more time to get these businesses back up and running, allow them to do what they want to do, and that's to create jobs, keep their employees, doing it safely, of course. But I think that, you know, in my view, the General Assembly had no choice but to make one last effort at this, do everything, leave no stone unturned to get these businesses back up and running, allowed to be back.
The other side to that is that, you know, we're seeing in the other states these businesses, it's not possible to open these businesses in a safe way. And it means that people are going to die and people are going to get sick if we open these businesses. And that's why we have to ultimately leave it to the public health officials. And in our state, the public health officials respond and report to the governor. That's the only way to really do this.
You know, and Rob, you're right. You know, I mean, the governor owns this.
I want to move on to and talk a little bit more about what I think has been a part of this conversation, which is the power dynamic between the governor and the legislature, but also actually with other top elected officials in the state. We've seen this week there was another call by a Republican member of the Council of State. That's, of course, the council of 10 of the state's highest elected officials, for Governor Roy Cooper to include them more on his decisions regarding public health issues during the pandemic. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest has filed a lawsuit over all of this. And this week, State Treasurer Dale Fulwell criticized the governor as well. Becky, should the governor defer more to the Council of State when implementing executive orders?
You know, I don't know whether defer is the right way. You know, should he seek their concurrence? Should he get their advice? I absolutely think that he should. The way that the current law is written, the Emergency Management Act, that gives the governor authority to act and act solely during emergencies, does say that, you know, when it was written, when it was construed, it was in response to and anticipating emergencies like hurricanes or flooding or things like that that were very short-lived. Nobody anticipated that these complete authority would go on for months and months and months. There is some constitutional questions about whether or not the governor is acting appropriately and with the constraints of the law. I mean, I think there is a legal question, a legitimate legal question to be asked with that. But just from a public policy standpoint, I think if you're sitting in the room with other statewide elected officials, one of whom is the state treasurer, one of whom is the agriculture commissioner, one is the superintendent of public instruction, one is, you know, all of the different things, the Department of Labor, the commissioner of labor. You've got all of these other statewide elected officials with their area of expertise. It seems to me that it would serve the governor and serve the state well to really take their advice and to really have not just concurrence, but a robust discussion of these things. And he has not done that. He has left them out. He has insisted on these virtual meetings, this contentious meeting that occurred this week. I mean, the meeting was scheduled to last several hours. Things got heated. He just said, I've got to go, and, you know, hit the exit button. You know, that is no way to conduct the state's business. And so from a legal standpoint and from a policy standpoint, yes, I think that the governor should concur with the members of the Council of State.
I think the law is pretty clear, actually, as Becky had said initially, that the authority really does rest with the governor here, and that's the only way that this is going to work. The Council of State is a bizarre institution to begin with. It's just a name we've attached to a group of people who happen to all have been elected to statewide office. We've got, like, the insurance commissioner and the agriculture commissioner. Why they would have any particular say in this, I think that's certainly not in their job descriptions. I think it makes much more sense to have the governor do this. I think it makes perfect sense if he feels a need to consult with these other officials. I have no objection to that. I don't have any doubt, though, that what this is about in this instance, in the midst of a very hard-fought election, that Treasurer Falwell and Lieutenant Governor Forrest, this is about Dan Forrest running against Roy Cooper for governor. That's what he's trying to do here. If Pat McCrory were governor, I guarantee you that the Republican members of the Council of State would not be arguing with him about his exercising his authority as governor. This is being driven by politics. Ultimately, though, the person who's responsible for these matters, the person that people of North Carolina look to is the governor. He's the one that's got to make these calls, and I have no doubt that that's how it's going to remain. If we want to change the law, if we want to make it so that a different body has some oversight over this, then the legislature needs to pass a new law, and we need to get that on the books to revise how this is governed. But for now, I think it's pretty clear that in these emergency situations, it's got to rest with someone like the governor.
The legislature tried to do that. They passed a law. The governor vetoed it. To clarify,
right. That's
those
how we pass laws, by getting compromise and working them out.
Well,
we don't pass laws with just, it takes two to tango.
Well, you just said if the General Assembly thinks it needs to be changed, they should pass another law, and they did. The governor vetoed it. So
they passed a bill. They didn't pass a law. They passed a bill. They passed their proposal.
They passed a bill.
And the way we get new laws is that both parties have to sign off.
It passed both of the bodies of the General Assembly. The governor vetoed it. I mean, that's the problem.
And the executive branch is part of the lawmaking process.
Rob, I would argue, too, just from a public policy standpoint, I mean, just set the politics aside completely and set the personalities aside. You know, if you're dealing with a months-long pandemic that affects the agriculture community. You know, we've seen some of these outbreaks in the meat processing plants and, you know, that are directly part of the agribusiness of North Carolina. Why would you not want to confer and get the advice of the statewide elected commissioner of agriculture? You know, with insurance, with a lot of the questions that we're having about insurance, why would you not want to? We're grappling, I mean, you know, the governor's got a really tough decision in front of him on how to open schools. Why would you not be conferring with the statewide elected superintendent of public instruction?
But if the governor needs to make, say, Becky, say, a very quick decision, does it make sense that the bill that you were referring to, does it make sense for him to need to get the approval or the support of a majority of the Council of State if, say, something like a hurricane comes through and he needs to act quickly?
Well, you know, the legislation, the changes to the law that have been considered are, you know, after a 5-day period or after a 30-day period. I mean, that's been baked into some of the proposals that have been out there. So, you know, to your point, yeah, I mean, if you have to make a rapid fire decision, that would still absolutely be allowed and the governor would be authorized to do that. But even for some really quick decisions, I mean, you know, a quick conference call with your Council of State members, doesn't seem to me that that's a hurdle that would be too difficult to get over unless, you know, as Rob suggests, you know, it's all driven by politics and nobody wants it to work.
You know, that we have the judicial branch, we have the legislative branch, we have the executive branch. The executive branch is not designed to work as a legislature or a mini legislature of 10 members. That's not how the executive branch works. The executive branch has specific authority that's designated to each office holder. And the governor is the person who has to oversee this particular area. They've got a whole nother staff, a whole Health and Human Services department, a whole team of experts that is designated to oversee this area, who has the experience. And it makes absolutely no sense for the governor to have to go through another, in effect, mini legislature to exercise his or her duties. This is something we invest in the executive branch. So I really don't think it makes sense to go down that road. But if we're going to go down that road, then let's pass a law, let's negotiate a law and get it done. And if we can't get that done, then we've got to rely on the statutes that exist. And the statutes that exist make it pretty clear it's the governor's responsibility.
And yeah, and again, I mean, the legislature passed a law and sent it over to him and, you know, he wasn't willing to work with them. So, you know, here we are. But I think, you know, once we maybe get past sort of the heated emotional part of this pandemic and dealing with it and the decisions that are being made, I think it's something that we as a state really need to look at and kind of redefine that. Because again, going back to my original comment, I don't think that the Emergency Act, the Emergency Management Act, was ever designed or had in mind for emergency that would drag on for months and months and months. And I think it's something that we should absolutely revisit.
Let's move on to another veto, actually. Governor Roy Cooper vetoed a bill this week that would have made some technical changes to the Department of Health and Human Services, but also would have sealed the details of investigations in which people die in police custody. This bill was the subject of recent protests, some of which, as you know, ended in a handful of arrests when demonstrators blocked Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. Since then, lawmakers have been trying to revive parts of that bill that had to do with block grants for DHHS. But Rob, was that the right move to veto the bill?
Oh, I think everybody agreed it was the right move. And the legislature itself has moved to, in effect, repeal what they'd already passed. So this is a classic example of two things. Number one, the folly of passing laws at 3 a.m. that nobody knows what they're voting on, which is just a lousy way to make legislation, especially given that they weren't even going home. The legislature's still in town. They could have dealt with that bill at any time instead of dealing with these things in the middle of the night. And second of all, it's a testament to one of the wonderful outcomes of the recent spate of police protests that we've had in this country, because it has awakened a whole group of citizens to paying a lot closer attention to this kind of nonsense. And it was great, I think, that the protests came out, that people spoke up, that they identified this, that open government people and people who favor sunshine in government spoke out, the media. And we learned that they had, you know, that this law, maybe it was well-intentioned, maybe they didn't think that they were doing what it ultimately would have done, but it was a mistake, and I think everybody's in agreement now that it was a mistake, and that's a good thing that the bill was vetoed. It's a good thing that the legislature, in effect, repealed it and is advancing legislation that would pass the non-controversial parts of that original bill.
Well, I agree with Rob. I mean, this is no way to do business. And, you know, what we saw was this was a bill that was requested by Governor Cooper's Department of Health and Human Services. You know, we call those agency bills. It came over to the General Assembly. I agree, and Rob and I have been agreement on this for forever, I think, in that, you know, passing bills in the middle of the night with no opportunity to fully vet and fully review things is no way to do business. That's the way that this whole thing happened. The governor vetoed it, and there was some thought, you know, there were a couple avenues to fix it. One would have been that the governor just let it go into law, and then the General Assembly had actually moved forward to repeal that part of that provision in the bill, and then the rest of it would have remained to be law. Just that one piece would have been repealed. The governor instead decided to veto the whole bill. So what's happened is the whole thing has died now. So there were some provisions in that bill that, you know, I think Rob and I would probably agree were good ideas and things that the department argued and put forward in that bill that were probably pretty necessary, some block grants from some federal money for some DHHS projects. But because the governor vetoed it, the whole thing now goes away. So we'll see if they come back and visit that later. When we're hearing they may come back to deal with some other budget issues if the federal government grants some flexibility for the COVID-19 CARES money. So they may be coming back to deal with that. That's something we're going to be keeping an eye on to see what happens to the rest of that bill, because with the governor's veto, the whole thing died.
But it's worth noting that the original bill, most of the provisions wouldn't have taken effect until October 1 anyway. So we've got plenty of time to get it right. And conceivably, they could still do it. I guess they're still in Raleigh. They could theoretically, they've already got a bill under consideration that considers all those points. So they could do it tomorrow if they really wanted to.
Well, and in the context of where we are right now, recent deaths in police custody, should we expect more reexamination of state policies that contribute to racial inequities?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's a huge problem that faces our society right now, is the general mistrust of the police, particularly when it comes to police misconduct and to racist, biased policing, which is just undeniably an unfortunate part of reality in modern America. So anything we can do to rebuild a measure of trust in police and in law enforcement is absolutely essential. And the last thing we need to do is to be sending the message that we're making things more secretive, more hidden, even if it's merely symbolic. Those are the kinds of steps we cannot be taking. It's critical right now that in America that we take every step within our power to rebuild some sort of healthy relationship between law enforcement and particularly the communities of color that have been so unfairly burdened and discriminated against.
I would argue that goes across the entire spectrum of state government. The more transparency we have, the better. The more that we know what our taxpayer money and what our elected officials are doing, the better. And, you know, to Rob's point about trust, I think, you know, trust between the law enforcement community and others, the protesters, but, you know, between taxpayers, between all of us. I would even take Rob's points and make it even larger in that the more transparency we have across state government, the better, and we should be working towards that.
Well, let's take a break from politics and talk about campaigning and fundraising, huh? Finally, shifting to the national stage, Republican Senator Tom Tillis is up for re-election this November. He now has the backing of President George W. Bush, who hadn't really been in the public eye much since he left office. But Tillis' Democratic challenger, Cal Cunningham, reported record-breaking fundraising numbers this quarter. And to be fair, Tillis' campaign had not released its latest numbers as of this recording, but he has been bringing in millions as well every quarter. Becky, I've heard y'all talk about it before. We knew this was going to be an extremely expensive race. But what else, if anything, do these numbers tell you?
It tells me, you know, one thing that kind of surprised me a little bit, and we're seeing these numbers, a lot of the campaigns are reporting their contributions and fundraising numbers and all. It surprises me a little bit, and I like this, that people are engaged in the political process. I mean, even in light of all of the COVID-19 and the health concerns, people's concerns about their businesses and revenue and jobs and, you know, all of those things, that people are engaged enough that want to engage in the political process. And I always think, you know, the more people that engage in the political process, the better. So I was a little bit surprised but heartened to see that. Yeah, we've talked about for months that we anticipate the North Carolina races, and particularly the Senate race, is going to probably set records for Senate races across the country and the amount of money and how expensive it is. You know, probably same with the gubernatorial race, some of the congressional races, you know, again. So what it also tells me is Rob and I were right, as we've been talking about this for months, that there's going to be a lot of money spent in North Carolina.
Yeah, I obviously agree. It's a huge, huge plum as the two parties compete to see who's going to control the Senate. Senator Tillis he's in such a difficult spot. He's got an interesting challenge, and I think this is part of the explanation why Mr. Cunningham has been so successful in raising money, because Tillis has tied himself completely to President Trump. And Trump is vulnerable on a lot of the issues that Cunningham has been championing. Cunningham is a military veteran, and there has now been a growing cascade of military veterans who've been speaking up, literally accusing the president of treason when it comes with respect to Russia, when it comes with respect to these bounties. I expect lots and lots of money to be pouring in from military veterans across the country who are just aghast at Trump's behavior. Tillis obviously has not specifically endorsed these just unbelievable behaviors of Trump, but he has linked himself to it. So Tillis is in a tough spot for his benefit. Bush, who's somebody who's pretty clearly distanced himself from Trump, is definitely a boost to Tillis. I'm sure he's going to welcome that with every ounce of his being, but it's going to be a real barn burner right down to the end. And Cunningham is a very formidable candidate. Tillis, I mean, I get emails from both of them every day, and I get emails from Tom Tillis, very concerned. They are these sort of exclamation points saying how worried he is, how all this money is being raised by his opponent. So he's obviously very concerned. He's in the fight of his political life.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rob. I think this is going to it'll be interesting for North Carolina. And then, you know, I mean, two good, strong candidates. You know, now Cunningham got pinged a little bit this week. He took some money from the PPP program that he had been very critical of. And so there's been some things of, you know, questioning his integrity and those kind of things. We will see more of that, I'm sure, as we go through this. But it's an interesting race. And, you know, once again, for those of us who really are kind of political junkies and watch this stuff, you know, this is going to be a heyday between now and November. North Carolina is going to be getting probably more attention than any other state in the country.
And not to mention the fact that we haven't really addressed how we're going to vote in this pandemic, which is another can of worms that we will probably have to open another week, unfortunately. Becky Gray is the Senior Vice President of the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is the Director of NC Policy Watch. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBerry will be back on the podcast next week when his guest will be Aisha Du, National Political and Program Director at Higher Heights for America. Until then, I'm Will Michaels. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast, and thank you for listening.